This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The world of high fashion enjoys an aura of glamour, prestige, and wealth. Think of names like Gisele Bündchen, Tyra Banks, and Kate Moss, and brands like Prada, Vuitton, Chanel, and Dior.
But for most fashion models, the industry is anything but glamorous, and it's certainly not lucrative. Most of them toil without job security or health insurance. They struggle to find work, and when they do, they earn lousy money before the industry casts them out at the ripe age of 26.
Well, that's the view of the fashion modeling industry from Boston University sociologist Ashley Mears in her new book, Pricing Beauty: Value in the Fashion Modeling World. Ashley Mears worked as a model when she was younger and returned to work in a New York modeling agency while researching her book, and she joins us now. And Ashley Mears, great to have you.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So you write that in this industry, models are scooped up, tried out, and spit out in rapid succession. That really doesn't sound consistent with a popular notion that we have of sort of these glamorous lives on the runways of New York, Paris, and Milan.
Right. No, it doesn't. And part of the problem is that our public perceptions are skewed by the nature of a winner-take-all hierarchy. So economists would describe modeling and many other markets and culture industries as a winner-take-all structure. You have a handful of people at the very top, the Giselles and the Kate Mosses, that are commanding a great deal of money, and they're making very visible, very lucrative rewards. We read about them in Forbes magazine. But their success obscures the huge pile, the majority of models who are trying to get there. There's very few winners, and the bulk of the, forgive me for saying, losers or contenders, we don't get to see them. But indeed, they struggle. They are technically independent contractors. They work without health insurance. And theirs is a very precarious labor market.
And in your book, you write about the financial reality of some of these, I guess the 99%, to use a phrase that we're hearing out on the streets today. You write about the reality of a small modeling firm in New York in which you worked. And I think, if I have this right, you found that 20% of the models there were actually in debt to the agency.
Yes. And this is something that people often find very surprising, that when I signed up to work at the agency as part of the research project, they sent me out to castings. Castings are unpaid. Castings are expensive. You need a portfolio. You need pictures to have on what are called composite cards that you leave with a client that has your contact information on it. You have to pay for all kinds of things that you wouldn't really expect. So, for instance, having your picture on the company website, there's a fee for that. Having pictures put in your portfolio, the portfolio itself as a physical object is actually pretty expensive. Having bike messengers in New York City travel from client to client and carry your portfolio with them can add up significantly, anywhere from $5 a week. At sometimes I was getting charged $50 a week. Modeling is an expensive job. So, when I started working, I started working right away. I was in school, so I wasn't working full time because I had to be in the classroom for part of that time. But I started booking jobs, catalog jobs that paid $1,000 or $2,000 a day, which I thought as a grad student was amazing money.
Sure, that sounds like good money.
I didn't get paid for 4 months.
I see.
I would receive voided checks that had a long list of my expenses, and I was still in the red. And it took a while to climb out of that. So models, especially if they're doing what's known as editorial work, in which they're working for high-status jobs, like in the magazines or in the Fashion Week catwalks that we've just seen and they're wrapping up now, those jobs are very high prestige, but they don't pay very well.
You talk about this real division between the editorial modeling jobs, right, versus the commercial modeling, which is what? Which is catalog work, you said?
Right. So models that work in the commercial segment, those are models that are doing catalogs. They're also doing showroom work. These are the models who literally work as mannequins and designers pin clothes onto their bodies. It's very much behind the scenes, but it's incredibly lucrative.
That seems counterintuitive. It seems like the other kind of model, the ones working for the prestigious The companies would be working much, be earning much more.
The models that get all the prestige, inversely, they're the economic losers, if you will. And the models that have less prestige are the ones that are, as commercial models, they're what an agency would call the bread and butter of an agency. They have steady earnings and pretty high, consistent earnings. The editorial models, however, in the long run, if we think long terms, that this is a hedge that agents and models are involved in, because if you accrue enough prestige, if you accrue enough glamour and appear in enough fashion catwalks for the right clients, they may not pay you a lot now immediately, but in the long run, the hope is, and the bet is, and it's a risky bet, but somebody might see you in a magazine or on the catwalk and give you a long-term multimillion-dollar luxury brand campaign. That's the jackpot.
So it's the jackpot. It's a very small possibility, a very small percentage possibility that you would actually cash in on that. But that's what sort of keeps people in this business. Because my next question was going to be, why do so many models operate against their own economic interests? And I guess that's the answer, right?
Well, it's actually something that's worth a larger conversation for people that work in all kinds of so-called cool and creative industries. So people that work in, for instance, publishing or art and music are in the same kind of losing game. That the startup costs are high, the benefits are non-existent, and the risks you have to deal with on your own. That said, it's like playing the lottery. Mm-hmm. You realize that the probability is slight, but the possibility is incredibly seductive. And you see Giselle, you see Kate Moss, they're everywhere. And you're going on castings, and it's very unlikely, but the chances are that you could, that you're in the moment, that you could potentially be there. That's one reason, a kind of economic reason. But there are many other reasons that are non-economic of why people would participate in the modeling industry, especially why young women would participate. It's one of the most highly celebrated roles for a woman to be celebrated for her beauty.
Hmm. Now, even though you had a certain experience in this field and a certain academic remove and wisdom about it, you write that you were somewhat seduced by that promise,
yes,
or fantasy that you could strike it rich, right?
Right. Yeah. No, of course I was. And there was a moment in graduate school where I was thinking, oh, I can just quit graduate school and go be a model because I'm here and I'm doing these castings in New York. And I was being seduced by the very buzz dynamics that I was documenting. Then I came back to reality and thought, wait a minute, I'm 24. I've been advised to lie about my age to say that I'm 18. I'm 10 years older than some of the models that I'm encountering on castings.
So
jobs.
At 24, you were already considered over the hill.
At the editorial end of the market,
yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, because at the editorial end, it values edginess, cutting edge, fashion, modernity. The sense that if you are over a certain point, you're no longer fresh, you're no longer cutting edge.
And what does that mean? I mean, I want to talk to you a little bit about the title of your book, Pricing Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who sets the price? Or maybe, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, what determines a model's chances of success in an industry, in a world that is glutted with beauty? I mean, what makes that edge?
Right. It's a similar kind of question that other sociologists have argued in art worlds or music and television. What makes a success? Where does the value come from when there are no immediately obvious or standardized criteria for choosing? The way that I document the value production, as I describe it in the book, is that among the editorial producers, the people that are booking the fashion shows and the magazines, they're looking for something that's edgy. Mm. It's amorphous. It's undefinable. What is the edge? They have a very hard time saying it. So they say things like, it's just my personal taste, or I just know it when the model walks in the door. But really, when I interviewed them and observed how they make these choices, it became very clear that they keep very much in tune with what other producers are choosing.
Mm.
And we see this across markets. When there's high uncertainty and you don't know what's the next step to do, you look at what your fellow competitors are choosing. So I found there's an enormous amount of imitation. There's also imitation along status lines. So whatever the high-end producer is choosing, whoever Prada sends down their catwalk, this becomes the edgy look of the moment, and everybody converges on it.
And can you talk about how this look, and this sort of gets us into essentially the way the industry is utterly wrapped up in a particular image of female beauty, tall, thin, young, very young, to the point that you need to lie about your age. What is going on in that industry? You describe a sort of self-perpetuating network of agents, of designers, of all these folks that just keep perpetuating this idea of female beauty because that's what's there to begin with. Right,
right. So that's part of it. That's culture. These are the larger cultural constraints that at the elite end, the high end of fashion, the look that is valued is one that is very slim, very young, and in fact also very white, which contrasts with a more inclusive and diverse kind of beauty that you would see in the catalog market, because in the catalog market, you have a different audience. Catalogs are trying to hit their bases and appeal to all of their consumers and a diverse array of consumers. At the editorial end, the look that is valued is one of edgy distinction, precisely not what the catalog market is going to appreciate. They're looking for something totally different. And that difference is defined as something that is elite, something that is high-end, that correlates with white and thin and young. And this is a something specific in the cultural system of the West of what is considered beauty. That said, though, because you have all of this imitation in the high end, you have what we would say a collective action problem, that the bookers, when I spoke to them, and the casting directors, when I spoke to them, they're troubled by this. They don't like the idea that they're reproducing a very white, young, thin look. They don't look like that. They think it's unrealistic. And yet they feel constrained by the self-perpetuating market.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things I'm interested in is this influx of foreign talent, young women from abroad who are willing to work for even less.
Yes.
Tell us how they were, how you observed how they were treated.
Well, this is a historically specific thing that happens in the 1990s. You have the proliferation of model scouts and the scouting industry. You have the ease of travel, the rise of the internet and digital technology, digital photography. So scouts are able to go to all corners of the globe and look for people who are ready and willing to leave home and accept work. They're going to the whitest parts of the world, by the way. So they scout heavily in Brazil, but they go into South Brazil where the Giselles are, because there's a history of German immigration. I didn't document such a distinction in the way that foreign models are treated compared to models who are from New York or from London, where I did my research. But I did document an extreme anxiety among the agents in particular of how to deal with this global glut, because it means there's a decline in rates across the board. There's a shrinking pie when you have so many more competitors.
Mm. Well, Ashley Mears, it's a fascinating view of the industry. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The book is Pricing Beauty, Value in the Fashion Modeling Work World. Ashley Mears is an assistant professor of sociology at Boston University.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.